Monday, November 29th, 2010, Ethics. So it's Dead Week. Final exam study guide is going around. It's posted on Moodle for the online students. Office hours during final exam week will be different than the regular term, and I'm still trying to work out some meetings and things, so I'll have those available on Wednesday. I will announce them in class on the podcast, and I'll also put those up on Moodle in an announcement. The final exam is the same drill as before, same format. Starting now. The final exam is the same format as before. The only difference will be that the lab will be open 4 days for you to take the final. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday closes at 5, which means the absolute last time you can get to the lab to take your final will be Thursday at 4.
This Thursday?
Next Thursday. Thursday of final exam week. So, final exam week, next week, you'll have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Lab closes at 5. You must get there 1 hour beforehand. Can you stop talking, please? Thank you. So you can have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Thursday at 5 is when the lab closes. You have to get there 1 hour early, which means 4 o'clock. That does not mean that the final in this class is Thursday at 4. It means that's the absolute last time you can get in there to take it. I encourage you to go earlier. The lab's open until 8 o'clock in the evening, so you can take it Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, anytime the lab is open, and the hours are on the final exam study guide. The final will not be comprehensive. It will only cover the ontology through the material at the that we're doing right now, chapter 10. So chapters 7, 8, 9, and 10, I believe. It's chapter 7, deontology. Deontology, Aristotle's virtue theory, Nietzsche, and moral and political philosophy. So those four chapters. Any questions? You get a 3x5 card of notes front and back for the exam. Grades will be available by the following Wednesday. So the Wednesday following final exam week, your grades will be available probably in the afternoon on Express Line. Yeah.
If we submitted the extra credit essay, do you know when we'll know our score?
Let me say this weekend sometime, probably. Most probably. So, I would say I might get some of them in the middle of the week, but I'll have them done this weekend. So they'll be done before Monday morning when finals start. I can't guarantee any time before that because it's a busy week for me too. So, and I didn't get, I just barely chipped away at the mountain of things I had to get done during vacation or Thanksgiving break. Let's see. Other questions about the final? X-Credit. I think what else?
There's an extra credit forum on Moodle. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for reminding me of that. So there's two forums this week. There's the regular week 10 forum, and there's also the extra credit forum. The extra credit forum will do you no good if you've been perfect about getting your post done, sufficient length, on time, etc. But if you missed one, you can do this forum, and you can get that point back. So it's just... We'll just replace one that you missed during the term, which is, 1% of your grade might be the difference between an 89 and a 90 or a 79 and an 80 or B minus or a B. And so I'd suggest that if you missed one, you do that. There were a few people that posted comments which were too short this week that I noticed. Make sure you got 100 words there. You can paste it into WordPad, Microsoft Word, or you can go to wordcount.com on the internet, paste it in, and make sure it's 100 words because you need something substantial to get credit. Also, make sure that you press that submit button like at 11:54, 11:53, because some of them, if it comes in at 11:55, it's late. And the deadline is before 11:55. So ideally, you post it on Friday or Saturday or Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening, and you're not there typing away at 5 minutes before the deadline. So just make sure to observe those rules for the Week 10 form and the extra credit form. The extra credit form is kind of free form. I'll have a topic up later just so you can reply to it, but it'll just be chime in on some issue that we've talked about during the term. From chapter 7 through 10. So I want it to be on the material which will be in the final. So anything on the study guide or any comment or question you had about any of the material which will be on the final, you can post on for the extra credit form. And I'll have topics up after class. Also, brief announcement, our office hours will be 3:30 to 4 today because I have to go to a dance department meeting. So apologies for that. Short notice on the department meeting. Okay, well, let's talk about moral and political philosophy. And then we'll talk about, and to start out with, I guess we'll be talking about fundamental issues in morality. So we've gone over all the various theories about what things makes things right and wrong. And at the end of the day, you pay your money and you take your choice. So in thinking about arguments for realism versus anti-realism, sometimes you'll see an argument of the form, if no one believed in absolute morality, or you might, but usually cast it in terms of realism. Sometimes people will also add universalism. There would be chaos and anarchy. I'm not that big on chaos. I kind of like anarchy, but I'm not sure the chaos and anarchy are necessarily related. But this is the way it's usually put. Chaos and anarchy. So, therefore, the argument goes, there must be absolute morality, or absolute moral truths, let's put it that way. Is this a valid argument? And if not, why is it invalid? Or if it's valid, why is it a good argument? Yes, sir.
I think it's invalid because you're making a judgment that there was morality. You know, how do you quantitate where, you know, I mean, I don't think the two are necessarily combined. You could have, like, indigenous tribes where there's no chaos and there may not be a morality there.
But even indigenous tribes, they have beliefs like, well, you know, you can't, steal somebody else's wife and take his, you know, spear, his really good spear, and replace it with your crappy spear, and that you shouldn't, like, you know, stab your friend in the back to take his really neat basket or whatever. It's, I mean, they have some, their rules might not be the same as ours, they might not be as abstract, but it seems like they still have some semblance of moral rules. Yeah?
It seems like it's not really saying anything. It's that statement gives the implication that any time that there is order, it's as a result of morality. So I mean, you can just call law morality or order morality and just use that word for anything and really say anything.
Yeah, so one question is you might question whether this if-then statement is true. Is it if no one believes in absolute morality, would there really be anarchy and chaos? You know, maybe the world might not be that much different than this world. So one is you might reject the if-then statement. Would anarchy, you know, really result? You know, maybe if people were following self-interest, maybe the world would be better. Nobody would be think in terms of making sure everybody's absolutely equal and making sure everyone's treated fairly. I mean, you wouldn't have a disproportionate number of resources going to screw-ups than people that can't do anything right. So you might think, well, self-interest might be the way to go. So it's not clear that you'd have a total degeneration, because it seems that, as Hobbes points out, your short-term narrow self-interest might be beat up your neighbor, take his stuff. But your long-term self-interest is there's law and order so that I can be safe and secure in my property and persons, so that the guy next door doesn't beat me up and take my stuff. And so it might be that enlightened self-interest would lead to a civilization of the sort we have now, or even better. If no one even thought, imagine like no one even thought in terms of moral categories, or there were no altruists, that everyone followed self-interest. Maybe just people's self-interest would be in voluntary cooperation. So that's one. So this is sort of a Hobbesian argument. Hobbes says that following enlightened self-interest, is what leads to civilization. We wouldn't go back to state of nature. But how about a more fundamental objection? This is kind of a cause and effect objection. What is it that keeps people from running wild in the streets? Is it fear of the law? Is it that they're naturally sympathetic or beneficent? Is it that people fear God and fear God's punishment in hell? Is it because they want to stay out of jail and keep their friends? You know, so there's any number of explanations for that. And all these things have to do with the human nature and the nature of human motivations. But is there a more fundamental logical problem with this suggestion? What if we took, instead of absolute morality, what if we inserted the word God instead? Sometimes to see whether an argument is valid, if you swap out a term and see if it makes sense, you can see whether it's logically valid or not. Like, if I say, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's a valid argument. And you can put any true statements in there and come up with the same, it's going to be valid no matter what you plug in there. So if you can say, okay, so all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So if you say all A's are B's, X is an A, therefore X is a B, as long as you put the same term into all the A's and all the B's and all the X's, like X, every time you have Socrates, you put in something else. And every time you take man, you put in the same thing. And every time you put moral, you put in the same thing. You can get a valid argument such that if these two things are true, then this has to be true. That's the definition of a valid argument. The premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. So if this were a valid argument, we should be able to put in the word God here and end up with the same conclusion. So let's see, if no one believed in God, there would be chaos and anarchy. And this is maybe what a divine command theorist might say. Look, what keeps people from running wild in the streets is because they're worried about the last judgment. They're worried about God punishing them or sending them to hell or not getting to heaven. Therefore, there must be, here again we're going to assert, instead of absolute moral truth, we assert there must be a God. Does that sound like a valid argument? If nobody believes in God, there'd be chaos. Therefore, there must be a God. Doesn't sound as convincing, does it? At least it doesn't to me. But there, it just shows that there's a negative consequence for having a particular belief. It doesn't say anything about what's true about the world.
Right.
It might be that God is a useful fiction, and maybe belief in God is what keeps people from running wild in the streets. Doesn't mean there is a God. It might be that, as an example, the Aztec society, it might be that sacrificing to the sun god is what kept that civilization together. That doesn't mean that there is a sun god. It might be that believing in Zeus held ancient Greek society together. Doesn't mean that there is a Zeus, you know, for hurling thunderbolts down from Mount Olympus. So this is just talking about a belief. And just because there would be a negative consequence for a belief doesn't mean that that belief is true. So this is a fallacious argument. And maybe I should write that out. Just because there is a negative consequence for a belief, let's see, in this case it'd be a belief in not having a belief. It has to say not having a belief. It doesn't mean that belief is true. It could be a useful fiction. Plato actually talks about this in his Republic. He talks about the noble lie. And he has this idea that the people who rule get told this story that, well, you're better than everybody else, so this is why you need to live apart from everyone and not have lots of possessions and live in a special house and be isolated from people. And the real reason is because if the people in power are able to have all the nice things that everybody else gets, then they're going to get drunk with power and start lording it over people. And so Plato has this idea of telling them that they're so good that they need to live a simple life of justice, when in reality that's a lie. And he said, and part of this is he says you tell the people who rule that the stars destined them to be rulers, when that's a lie too. But the idea is that you tell them this to kind of make them big in the head, so they're not good at good ideas, and so they think they're special, and then they take all this other stuff you're putting on them, like they have to live in a public housing, and they don't get all the riches and gold and silver and all the stuff the merchant class gets. So you feed them this line of bull, basically, to make them do what they're supposed to do and function in society. So in the same way, you might think that God might serve a useful purpose, the concept of God. But that's perfectly consistent with there not being such a being. In the same way, morality might serve a useful purpose. It might be that without a belief in absolute morality, that society would fall apart, that you would degenerate into violence and chaos. But that doesn't mean there is such a thing as moral truth. It could just be, morality just could be a useful convention, kind of like Hobbes says, right? If morality just kind of is a useful fiction. Objections, questions, comments? So long and short of this is a really bad argument for morality. Let's see. So if this is a bad argument for morality, are there any good arguments for morality? So this is the challenge of moral skepticism that says, well, why is, going back to Glaucon, why is justice better than injustice? So a couple of things people have said to try to justify morality. You know, where does moral knowledge come from, and how do we know there is such a thing as right and wrong? One idea is this idea of moral intuitions. So most modern ethicists say moral intuitions are the data of moral philosophy. And they have this idea of doing thought experiments, and we saw a lot of these in the utilitarian discussion experiments. Are like the controlled experiments in empirical science. I guess we'll just add science. So sometimes when we look at some of these examples, like I think of some really improbable ones. Well, like the fat man, he's a big owl. He's stuck in the cave, and you just happen to have some dynamite with you. And so you can blow up Big Owl and clear the cave entrance, but you're killing him. And the question is that moral? Is that moral or not? And some people will say, not just like your average students that maybe aren't used to these kind of crazy examples, but you even get philosophers like Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand hated examples like this. She says, this is ridiculous. This has nothing to do with the real world. It's totally divorced from reality, because when are you going to be in a cave with a bunch of dynamite and some guy with a weight problem stuck in the cave entrance, right? That's never going to happen. So talking about such hypothetical examples, she said, is ridiculous and unproductive and a waste of time. Now, modern ethicists would disagree. And they say, people like Nozick, for example, who really likes Rand's political philosophy, even if maybe he disagrees with her epistemology. But Nozick, who came up with the experience machine, right? He thinks that these thought experiments help you hone your moral intuitions. It helps you reflect on what's of value to you and how values are related. So imagine imagine you're doing that, like an experiment in your chemistry class, right? And so let's see, what you take some scientific grade pure sulfur and pour out exactly 15%. And then you take some charcoal and you pour out 10%. And then you pour out 75% potassium nitrate, and you these are all pure refined chemicals, and you mix them together in just the right amount, and you put them together, and then you put a match to it, and it goes boom, right? And your chemistry professor draws a bunch of equations and says, this is why there was an explosion. You've just created gunpowder. And that explosion is a rapid oxidation of those chemicals, mixed in that certain way. And what if you raise your hand and said, but professor, I object to this experiment. You would never find pure sodium nitrate or sulfur in nature. It exists in an impure form. In order to create this, we had to artificially refine these chemicals. That person has missed the point, right? What the professor and what the science of chemistry is trying to get at is, what is it that makes things do what they do? What is the nature of reality? What is the nature of the chemicals we find around them? What are the nature of these particular elements? And how do they interact with each other? And that's what philosophers are trying to do with ethics. What is ethics? Is ethics the same for everyone? Does each person have their own code of ethics? And these are mutually exclusive answers. And so in order to do this, you think up possible thought experiments. And these are like the controlled experiments in science, in that there are things that which probably never will occur in the real world. So you have experiments with a trolley going down the train. It's going to hit some kid, or it's going to hit the guy's car, right? You got some kind of VR machine that gives you all the pleasurable experiences you would want, but nothing else. And you ask yourself, well, would I want to live in a world like that? Would there be anything missing? And so it helps you reflect on what the nature of value and the nature and how values are related, and whether there are some values which are the only values, whether some values are more important than other values, and so on. And then you come up with counterexamples. So if you're a utilitarian, you have to deal with the fact that it seems like you'd have to sanction wanton murder, even like killing a little baby. There might be a case in utilitarianism where you could design a scenario where you would have to kill a little baby to save, say, 100 people. And utilitarian would say you should do it. Well, there's a question about, is that the correct moral theory? And so you run through these experiments and you see, the comment with the murderer at your door. Should you lie to a murderer to save your friend? And again, these are improbable examples, but they help you hone your moral intuitions. And so what philosophers would say is that, most modern philosophers who are realists say that you hone in on the nature of moral reality by reflecting on moral values, and that these hypothetical experiments help you do that, and that these intuitions you have, about the clear case, what you do is you take all of these intuitions, and they're like sense perception. You take all these perceptions and you put them into a theory, and you come up with some abstract principles, right? So you do a bunch of experiments about the rate at which objects fall and the force that objects hit other objects with, and you come up with an equation like F equals ma. Force equals mass times acceleration. So if you take the force of an object, it's always equivalent to the mass of an object multiplied by the acceleration of an object. And you can do all sorts of experiments that verify this is true. Well, in the same way, you can think about odd implies can, according to modern philosophers. If you think about the concept of moral obligation, it's hard to come up with a scenario where you really have to do something, where you would be a bad person for not doing it, and you can't do it. So, you take a particular example. Okay, there's a drowning child. There's no one around. So crying for help won't make any difference. Do you have an obligation to swim out and save the drowning child? If you can't swim, the answer is no. Why? Because you can't have an obligation to do something that it's impossible for you to do. And so it's thought that you can kind of put in these particular examples and plug them in and come up with some abstract principles like, what is it that all moral actions have in common? They produce the greatest happiness, according to Mill. Or according to Kant, they don't violate an absolute moral rule derived from reason. They aren't an instance of you acting in one way and expecting other people to act in another. You're acting so that Kant's exact statement. You're acting as if your actions were a universal law, is what Kant says. Or you're treating people as ends in themselves and not as merely as means. Or in Aristotle's case, it's virtue. It's you're acting in a way which leads to success, and you're embodying the virtues which allow you to obtain success if you're lucky enough. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yeah.
By the audience, implies can actually. Everybody agrees that's how it should be, right? But in reality, I mean, we can see like survivors. A survivor's deal, for example, goes completely against the implies can. It may be an actual real nature that doesn't really work. I mean, we can all agree that it should, but it doesn't. So I don't know. So I think that's a good indication that some theories adjust
on
how much sense they make,
they
adjust on truth.
Yeah, I mean, this raises an interesting question, is how do you tell genuine moral intuitions from irrational feelings, cultural bias? Etc. I think that is a real problem. I think with survivor's guilt, I mean, most most people classify survivor's guilt as a pathology. It's an irrational feeling. Because you think, I feel guilty over something I have no control over. You have people who feel guilty over being molested as a child, or being the victim of sexual assault. And they feel guilty even though they recognize from a rational point of view that they were a child and there wasn't anything they could have done about it. And but on the other hand, they feel a sense of shame or guilt. And you know, people go to therapy to get rid of those feelings. And it's not enough to rationally realize that, but you have to get rid of those feelings. But then the question is, why do people think those feelings are irrational? And people tend to think there's such a thing as rational guilt. Well, you go back to like what things most people from a rational point of view would say. Well, those when I harmed another person and I could have done otherwise, that's where I should feel guilty. When somebody did something to me that wasn't my fault, then I shouldn't feel guilty. And that goes back to this kind of try to put these things into some sort of larger logical context, into a theory that makes sense out of all these feelings and intuitions and vague notions we have about what's right and wrong. And a lot of people think this is a pipe dream, that human beings are just this hopeless jumble of half-baked notions, and that morality is kind of a byproduct of social evolution, and it's a combination of conflicting notions. A lot of philosophers think that no, that there is a moral reality, and that we can comprehend it through reason. And that's what modern ethics is, in large, what they call normative ethics is all about. I should mention, see, there's a distinction between meta-ethics. Meta-ethics and normative ethics. Normative ethics is this idea of having a systematic theory to guide action and explain what makes things right or wrong. Meta-ethics is this question, is sort of what is morality? What justifies it? Is it the same for everyone? So those are just questions we dealt with early in the course, and those are the sort of fundamental issues in morality, about the nature of morality itself. Once you accept the realist position, then the question is, well, okay, I agree that there is such a thing as morality. I agree that it's the same for everyone. And so now, what are the particulars? What is it that makes a certain thing right and wrong? Is it God's commands? Is it self-interest? Is it producing the greatest happiness? Is it rules derived from reason? Is it living according to those virtues which lead to a successful life? So all those are, or is it about the will to power and getting rid of bad things like pity and living like a master, as Nietzsche would say, replacing pity with callousness. So those are all the different answers, and these are all versions of normative ethics. So if you look on like page 6, that chart there, all the versions of absolutism or universalism, those are all particular kinds of normative ethics. Meta-ethics is all these other questions about: is there such a thing as morality? Could it be different for different people? I guess those are the two major meta-ethical questions. And I suppose also about where if there is no such thing as morality, why do people believe in it? But modern ethicists embrace this idea that there is Thanos morality, and there is a way to come up with a comprehensive, rational, systematic theory about what things are right and wrong and how you should live your life.
It seems like it's always evolving. Like I noticed with the sports, like the other day they got rid of some coach from California that was having the players fake injuries against Oregon the other day. They just dropped down and start holding their leg, and it looked kind of weird, and it was. They were actually faking these injuries. And, huh. So then that falls into the morals or ethics, and it seems like there are always people pushing it from both sides, you know, the boundaries, and then what do you do about it, you know?
Yeah, and that's more of a kind of a pragmatic question. What do you do about if morals are going downhill, you know? And that, you might say that that's a question for sociologists and psychologists or something, or maybe the clergy. Try to exhort people to be more moral. Most philosophers are, although I think there's been some change in this lately, but most philosophers are more concerned with sort of the scientific, the kind of scientific approach. Like if you, like there's questions about like, you go to the astronomy department, right? And they'll tell you all about the planets, and they'll show you pictures from the Hubble telescope, and they'll tell you how the universe began as a singularity, and they'll show you a bunch of equations that explain how everything came to be, how you get, how the sun works, how you got all the planets, why you have galaxies and solar systems and so on. But if you ask them, okay, but how do we get to Mars? They'll say, well, that's not our department. That's engineering. And so I think the philosophers tend to pass the buck, and they'd say, well, we're doing the hard thinking here, and we're trying to figure out, well, what is the good life, and how should we lead it, and then what things are right and wrong, what makes them so. And it's up to, you know, individuals, organizations of various kinds, psychologists, sociologists, maybe, you know, maybe even the government, to try to help people, to try to make people more moral. Because there's a sort of common everyday morality that most people believe in, and then there's these sort of controversial issues. And I think ethics probably helps more with controversial issues, but the argument is that if you can really understand what it is that makes hitting an old lady over the head and taking her stuff wrong, then you can take that same insight along with the insight about what makes telling a lie wrong, what makes cheating your friend wrong, or what makes cheating your ethics test wrong. You take all those things, and once you get a lot of data about morality, you might be able to figure out, is stem cell research wrong? Or is capital punishment just? So the idea is that you take all your intuitions about the really clear case that almost everyone agrees on, you come up with a theory, and if you have a robust enough abstract theory which explains all the clear cases, you can then use that theory to apply to the controversial cases and get some guidance on those. Yeah?
Just a really quick observation. One thing I noticed about morals is that it seems that they are tied to purpose. I mean, like, if you think just in terms of, like, semantics, if you say, like, the moral of the story, if you were to interchange that with the point of the story or the purpose of the story, almost like, intuitively speaking, moral is the purpose behind what our actions are. So, I mean, I think in order to be able to make any kind of statements about what morals are, there would have to be purpose behind it. So the people that don't believe that there is any given purpose, they would be forced to say that there are no morals.
How is morality related to purpose? Like for somebody like Aristotle or even Nietzsche, it's really strongly related. Like Aristotle has this idea of being successful. It's all Nietzsche, it's about the will to power. Or for utilitarianism, there's this goal of maximizing happiness. Or even for egoism, it's about maximizing self-interest. It's not as clear with like a view like Kant's, where you have these absolute rules that you have to respect. The notion of purpose doesn't seem as strong there. But I think you're hitting on something about the distinction between a person having morals and a person having bad morals. So, and this is sort of like, you know, think about this. Jane has morals. Jane's morality is degenerate and perverted. And holy crap.
So what would happen if you took those statements and you tried to replace morals with purpose? Jane has no purpose. Jane's purpose is degenerate and perverted.
I suppose it depends, like, if you take a particular purpose, like, if Jane's purpose in life is to make Jane happy or something like that, you might say, well, the idea of living your life to make your own, just to make yourself happy, you might say, I suppose that might work. But it seems like the notion of purpose is maybe a little broader than that.
Or maybe even reasons, as opposed to purpose, just reasons.
Well, with reasons, though, you can have, it seems like you can have two kinds of reasons, though. You can have a self-interested reason, and you can have a moral reason. This goes back to Kant. I mean, Kant would say there's two reasons you do something. You wanted to do it, or you thought that you should do it. Now, somebody like Mill will say there's only one reason why you do something, because you want to do it. But people want to do things that, and people want, but people want to do things that are moral. Or sometimes. So, but Kant says you can act from pure reason, and that when you act from a moral point of view, you're not acting on desire. You're acting out of respect for the moral law. You're not saying, oh, I really want to do this, and therefore I'm going to do it. You're saying, although you do that sometimes, right? You'd say, oh, I'm thirsty. I want to take a drink. And you take a drink. Right? And you say, okay, good. I wanted something. That's this hypothetical imperative, right? How do I get what I want? Well, I'm thirsty. My throat's getting parched. I'm going to take a drink that's going to fulfill that purpose of having my throat, you know, feel good and be lubricated and be able to speak well. But then there's acting from a moral point of view, which it might be something like, when I'm done with this can, I'm going to recycle it. Why? Because it's my duty to recycle, because putting this in a landfill would be wasteful and it wouldn't respect the environment. That's a moral reason. It doesn't have to do with what I want. I might find recycling to be a pain in the ass and I might hate doing it, but I do it anyway. Why? Because I should do it. Yeah.
Well, because like with Nietzsche in particular, one of the things I found is it seemed when he was talking about things, he seemed a little short-sighted with some things. Like, for instance, it's like he says that the will to power is, you know, the purpose for life. Well, I mean, him coming from an evolutionary standpoint, there is actually no purpose for anything. Everything just is. So if that be the case, then it could be argued that there's really no purpose in life itself. And so therefore, immorality being something that is against life doesn't make sense, because then there would have to be a purpose for life. And if there's no purpose for it, then you can't say, oh, it's wrong because it doesn't help you stay alive.
Well, what if life is its own
reason? You have to stay
alive. Well, what if life is its own reason? I mean, Nietzsche is thinking in a lot of ways like Aristotle. What is the nature of not just man, but what is the nature of a living thing? The living thing tries to grow, dominate, and prosper. That's what life is. It, you know, life is this, in Nietzsche's view, perhaps a happenstance. It's organic matter, which is self-organizing and self-replicating and tries to make itself big and tries to exploit its environment to make itself great. And we should all aspire to that greatness.
So if that being the case, then couldn't it also be argued that since man is trying to become benevolent and compassionate, that those would also be things that are purpose-driven?
He would say that's a natural aberration.
Yeah, but at the same time, it happened naturally. So therefore, since it happened in nature, how could it be abhorrent?
Well, I think he would say it's a mistake. It's kind of like a genetic defect, right? So you end up with like someone with, you can kind of look at like, okay, here's what like 99% of human beings look like this, right? Two arms, two legs, symmetry, uniformity, average intelligence, And then you get some guy that's like walking around like this. Well, that guy, there's something wrong with him. He's screwed up. Nature made a mistake. And then Nietzsche thinks that you don't just have biological errors, but you have philosophical errors, which maybe stem from biology, like the guys who are all, you know, like this, who have debilitation, they create this kind of fiction that they put on the normal people to make them feel guilty, to make them spend all their times with like the weak and the sick and the botched and the repulsive and the useless and the incompetent instead of achieving. So that would be his argument. So that there is this life principle, but sometimes it goes wrong. And a morality of the sick and the deformed is basically what Christianity is. And it's a kind of deformed idea. Don't shoot the messenger. It's just, you know. So that's Nietzsche's view. Which is kind of a harsh view. We should go on talking about, let's go on talking about politics. Talking with my person across the hall about politics. She referred to Madison as a staunch Federalist. And then, which is just wrong in so many ways, but be that as it may. I thought, as a way of sort of rounding out the class, that moral and political philosophy are closely intertwined. And at the basis of every political judgment, you're going to find two things. You're going to find some kind of a fundamental moral premise, and you'll find an empirical belief. So, space. So, political. Political judgment. So you get a fundamental moral premise or premises, maybe more than one, and then empirical premises. I don't want to say factual premises because that sort of begs the questions about whether morality is factual or not. And so I don't want to assume that morality is not factual. Let's say empirical premises. Empirical means coming from the senses. So you'll hear, whenever someone's talking about what someone has a right to, or they use concepts like justice or fairness, those are all moral terms. And so people say, everyone has a right to a living wage. Everyone has a right to health care. Everyone has a right to free speech. Or they might say, it's not fair that a person of a certain ethnic heritage gets extra points when applying to an elite university. Or they might say, it's social justice entails that more money be spent in poor neighborhoods on public schools. And so you get all these arguments based on what's just, what's fair, what's right. Those are all moral arguments. But also mixed in with these, you get empirical premises. And what might be an example of a non-moral premise in a political argument? Something which is empirical, meaning it comes from the senses, something from science, meaning... economics, sociology, psychology, what might be a particular political judgment a person might have, or an empirical premise in a political argument. What about like gay people are born that way, right? So you might make the argument, look, here there's this, this doctor did all these autopsies on these people that died of AIDS and they all had this certain gene. And that's like the gay gene. So therefore, people who are gay are born that way. And that's an argument based on genetics, right? And based on certain studies. And so if that's a view, you might pair that with a moral belief that, well, if a person can't control their sexual preference, therefore they can't be blamed for their sexual preference, and that needs to be accommodated by society. And that would be a moral argument. You take those two things together, and you get an argument for gay rights. Now, of course, someone might say, well, wait a minute, is a person really born gay? And they might present a bunch of studies that show the contrary view. Or they might disagree with the idea that society has to accommodate the sexual preferences of a small group of people, even if it's natural. But in every moral judgment, you'll get usually both of these together. Everyone has a right to a living wage. That would be like a moral statement. But what about a contrary empirical statement? Or an empirical statement and a contrary argument might be something like the minimum wage is inflationary. And that's a pretty well-argued idea in economics, that if you raise the minimum wage, what happens is that gets priced into the products people buy. So even though you're going to benefit the people who are working there, the goods that you buy from that place are going to go up in price. So if every time the minimum wage goes up, what you have to pay at McDonald's, where there's a lot of minimum wage workers, is going to go up. The cost of food, the cost of anything that's done by people that work at the minimum wage will go up. Also, union labor is going to go up because that's based on the minimum wage. So those are things you have to take into account if you're going to pass a law raising the minimum wage, because you're going to have unforeseen consequences. Can we think of another example? How about one with capital punishment? Pornography. I need to think about some of those things. All the difficult issues. Any kind of
Abortion.
There you go. What about abortion? How about this? Here's an empirical fact that most abortion is done for the sake of convenience. Broadly construed, meaning you look at the reasons that people give in studies even done by Planned Parenthood, which is the number one abortion provider in the United States. Says, and the surveys show that the reasons people give for abortion, don't want to have another child, couldn't afford a child, unwanted pregnancy, the spouse or partner is upset about the pregnancy. And you look at rape, incest, or threat to the health of the mother, and you're looking at 2, 3, 4% of the people in those categories. And so that's relevant in that if you look at the reasons that people tend to have abortions, it's typically through irresponsible behavior or lifestyle choice. And so it's a very different moral argument when you're looking arguing over someone's going to die or someone was raped by their father. Those are extremely small, rare cases. And the vast majority of cases, it seems to make sense that you should base your policy on, which is people having unprotected sex and then not wanting to live with the consequences of their actions. But then how about a contrary argument? A woman has a right to her own body. Right? That's a moral statement. Yeah?
Well, another counter argument would be that the only reason the fetus is alive is based on your theology. If you don't believe in God, you can just go by, for example, proven science, and you just gonna say like the first 3 months in LA. And so it's not per se a person, for example, that's like purely theological argument, but I'm not the person.
The concept of a person is kind of problematic.
Exactly.
Yeah, if by person you mean rational, self-conscious being, then a human being doesn't become a first person until, at least a year after birth.
In Aborigines, yes, that would be...
Well, I mean, just speaking, you can tell that an infant shows no sign. I mean, physiologically, infants don't have rational self-consciousness until sometime after birth. Because when they're first born, their brain's still undeveloped, and it's not like there's some magical thing that happens when the baby shoots out of the birth canal.
Right.
So then So the question is, you know, what? How does that matter morally? But people, you can marshal these facts. You can say, well, you might, and the theological argument, you might say, well, okay, biological life begins at conception. And you can look at that scientifically and see that's true, that you get the egg that's fertilized by the sperm, it turns into a zygote, and the cells start multiplying. And you have a genetically distinct biological being, which has different sex than the mother, might have different blood type, and so on, and it's a biologically distinct entity. But then the question is, you know, does a zygote have rights? And that's more of a sort of a moral statement. So you can argue metaphysics, you know, and what makes a person and what gives a person the right to life, and that's more the moral part. But all of these come into an argument, and some of these might be scientific. Some of the arguments are empirical. Some might be moral. And again, you have a combination of the two in most political judgments. Yeah.
With abortion, it reminded me of a debate I had heard once, where the argument was is that the reason why abortion was allowable was because at that specific point, you know, they commented that the majority of people who had abortions for the sake of convenience, and so therefore the argument in justifying that abortion was okay was is that it was an inconvenience or a burden on the mother. Mm-hmm. And the other person in the debate said, well, okay, that be the case, then it's just arguable at what point in time that a human being is considered self-sustaining. Because if you take a newborn baby and you leave it out in the woods by itself, it's not going to survive.
Right.
Just because it still requires the aid of others. And so just because the mother is the only one that's capable of giving, you know, the fetus the life it needs, it's considered a parasite while it's in the womb. Well, until it's able to gather its own food, it's still considered a parasite. And so to kind of go with the ridiculous, the person that was arguing against abortion said that they should extend the age for abortion till the point that a human is capable of sustaining themselves, whether it be 13 years old or 18 years old, to the point where the parent is no longer accountable for making sure that that person survives. That should be a viable time for them to be aborted.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some moments where parents want to kill their children, but most people think that would be wrong. And so this always has to do with this idea of the thought experiments, okay? Well, if viability, if being able to sustain its life is necessary to have rights, then people who are on dialysis machines and on ventilators don't have rights, and infants don't have rights, and there's a lot of people who won't have rights. So it seems like that's too strong a theory, and that it, although it might solve your abortion, justify abortion, it's going to have all these other kind of weird consequences which don't make sense to people. And you didn't even have to bring Hitler into it. So like some other examples might be, pornography. So people talk about censoring pornography, and like one important question is, does viewing pornography as a young person, does that have an adverse effect on psychosexual development? Does it predispose adults to commit rape or acts of sexual assault? And those are empirical questions. They're a matter of psychological and sociological studies. They don't have to do with the moral premises at all. Now, you might have some moral premises involved, like, well, if there's something which causes harm to people indirectly, you know, it should be prevented, this idea of harm reduction. Or the idea that pornography shows disrespect for the rights of women, which is a kind of a feminist argument. Or you have a kind of moralistic argument of the social conservative, that it's disrespectful to women, or that it trivializes sex. And so you can have these arguments again from the moral side and then from the empirical side. And when you're making a political judgment, it's important to recognize these, because you might question some of these, either the fundamental moral premise, or you can question the empirical premise if you're looking to find a weakness in an argument. Yeah?
A good example of that is like the DUI laws. Every billboard that you see is this guy that killed this family of five. Well, his blood alcohol was already six times legal limit, you know, but they want to raise it up or make it more restrictive, lower it down. Well, every case that they put forth, the guy was already
you know, able to be prosecuted under the existing laws.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole reason their empirical premises were invalid, but it got everybody, oh, well, yeah, they're right.
Yeah.
So the moral premise was, no, you shouldn't drink and drive. You know, but there were existing laws capable of catching that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and often you see this, like, for example, people that want to censor pornography will point to child pornography, which is already illegal. And so they'll say, well, if you, you know, and they'll bring it up, they'll think about the children. But if you can't show harm to children in seeing pornography, and most of the studies show that when children see pornography, they think it's funny, gross, silly. Or once you get puberty, you're like, hey, that's kind of interesting, right? But once you start to develop sexually, but the idea that you're somehow traumatized by seeing pornography at a young age, none of the studies, and they've done studies in kind of more free, permissive societies, like even in Italy, which is nominally Catholic, and Spain, they have shows in the afternoon, which are like what we have on cable TV. Let's strip together. We get housewives doing striptease on TV, and you know, when kids are around, the kids can just turn on the TV and see it. But kids would rather watch cartoons, and it looks like there's no evidence that European children are actually, as it turns out, European children tend to be better about not getting pregnant by accident than American children, because they're told, okay, well, you know. If somebody you really want to have a relationship with or hook up with, just make sure you have protection. Whereas in America, it's the just say no, and then the contraception sort of added as an afterthought. But there's no evidence that European children are traumatized. So that would, you know, go into the political argument about what laws ought there to be about, you know, censorship of pornography and so on. Just as a particular example. Here's a question. To what extent are political judgments based on fundamental moral assumptions, and to what extent are they based on empirical beliefs about what conditions maximize human welfare? So this is kind of interesting. Think about tax cuts or economic policy, how much government you should have. Some of these arguments seem to be pragmatic and utilitarian. Some seem to be from a moral point of view. Just to take one example, people will say this. I hear people say this all the time. I just want the parties to get along. I want them to stop fighting and get things done. You hear people say that? I just want them to get things done. Well, I always ask, well, what do you want them to get done? I don't know. I just want them to, you know, pass laws and stuff. Like, well, what kind of laws? Like, you know, I want them to compromise. I mean, you got to work together. We're all in this together. We got to pull together. I said, well, wait a minute. Why don't you think they're getting things done? Well, it's because they don't agree on anything. Exactly. So there's roughly speaking, you know, we have a two-party system. There's one party who has one idea about what things are best. Another party has another idea about what things are best. And that's true both in terms of empirical beliefs and their moral beliefs. And the reason why they don't get anything done is because they have different ideas about what should be done. hence gridlock, which I don't know is such a bad thing. But this idea, this shows that you can't do politics purely pragmatically about getting things done. The question is, what should be done? You can't get things done until you have some value. Maybe this goes back to your statement about purpose. Unless you have some value guiding your action, getting things done is meaningless. It's just like the concept of change. Well, what kind of change? You get someone talking, well, elect me and I'm for change. Well, it's going to be different than what we got now, but how is it going to be different? And is it going to be better or worse? And how do you define better and how do you define worse? And so in the same way, in this idea that you can't do politics
pragmatically. Or, to put it another way, empirically, that this idea that politics is a science, I think, is apologies to Steve Kennedy and Stan on my political science. I mean, you can study politics as a science, the way it works. But as far as your politicians, I mean, people get elected, they're just, their skill is being able to fool you into voting for them. And, you know, lying well to different constituent groups, and mostly raising money to get elected, and being chelogenic and be able to give good speeches and make people feel warm and fuzzy and, you know, motivate people to go out there and check a box for them. But, I mean, they don't have any skills as far as, like, management skills necessarily or skills at anything except for getting people to elect them again. So if you think about this idea of a science of politics, it's not something you can do in a value-neutral way. And so every politician has values, and every political party and ideology has values. And so it's important to look at those values and see if you agree with them or not, or maybe you agree with a little bit of one here and one the other, but to recognize that there's values which are implicit in political judgments. That there's no way of escaping values. So coming back to values. So people say that you can't legislate morality. Legislation always comes from a moral point of view. It just depends on what moral point of view it comes from. And so you think about the two party system. When you think about like the two major parties, and maybe we could throw in the third just for third and fourth for last. If you think about the GOP and the Democratic Party, what values do you think about?
Money.
What's
that,
money?
Big business.
I agree with that or not. It seems like the Democrats are pretty buddy-buddy with big business. The GOP has always gone off on small business, going off about small business. I mean, the Democrats, yeah.
Well, GOP, they tend to favor inalienable rights, whereas Democrats favor civil rights.
Yeah, so maybe coming back to the business thing, maybe we could put business here, just not big business, but business in general. And generally, along with business, you know, you get free market capitalism. Which basically means the freedom to buy, sell, trade, invest as you see fit without a bunch of rules to worry about. Whereas the Democrats tend to favor unions, also the party of government, you know, government unions, government workers, education, right? There's a reason why everybody in, you know, this place votes Democrat, and why our union sends out, you know, messages that says, you know, you get out there and re-elect the Democrat governor. Why? Because he's a threat of education. Why? Because he's going to send a lot of money our way. Union's government,
social,
I'll put socialism over here. You know, they want the sort of idea of a mixed economy. I don't want to use the word fascism, which is actually more descriptive of our current economic system. Fascism is where the people that run businesses, they maintain nominal ownership of the business, but they pay a big chunk of taxes to the government, and then they and they have a bunch of rules and regulations to follow, and they get to keep some of their money. Which is more of the as opposed to socialism, where the government actually owns the means of production. In fascism, government government and corporations work hand in hand. Sometimes people call this corporatism. Sometimes these labels can be misleading. Sometimes people call it economy, which is some free market capitalism mixed in with public-private partnership, right? That sounds sinister. It's a lot better than fascism, but it's potato potato. Unalienable rights. And here you get civil rights or group rights. And actually, I don't know about civil rights. Civil rights is kind of broad things. Like Republicans really like some civil rights, like your right to free speech or freedom of religion. Civil rights. I'll put group rights here. And where the Democrat Party tends to think about people as members of groups. Yeah.
I guess I just don't know what the difference is. Like, with, say, the GOP are proponents of small government and unalienable rights, but generally the GOP legislation who seeks to control things like marijuana prohibition, drug wars, gay marriage, abortion, and it seems like they're more in favor for a larger government role in that aspect of people's lives.
You make a good point, so when nobody can see the point,
it's not like there's any more fair.
Which I can't do. But up here, so here, I think, I'll put this. Economic freedom. And here, you might put broadly, personal or social freedom. And this is kind of broad because there are certain freedoms that GOP likes, like the right to own a gun, the sort of religious freedom, and your right to eat something with trans fat in it, and your right to smoke a cigarette on a street corner or in a parking lot or whatever. So I mean the it's kind of weird the GOP like speaks. You get these conservatives speak vociferously against marijuana, and then, but they think it's an outrage, it's a government overreach if they try to keep you from smoking cigarettes. But somehow smoking marijuana is less dangerous. Can't let people do that. It's bad for their health. Well, what about cigarettes? What about that whiskey that you just didn't add for? So I'm always after Lars Larson about that. And so you think of like these two sort of groups that, and in my view, you get the GOP that says they're big on individual rights, but like you said, they have these sort of inconsistent views about use of drugs, about gambling, about pornography and prostitution. Then you got the Democrats that say they love freedom, but they want to take most of your paycheck, and they want to tell you whether you can eat French fries, and they lecture you on whether you're eating enough fruits and vegetables. And they tell you can't smoke cigarette in a public place or in a bar, and want to control you in all these other ways. They want to control the economy. They want to control whether you can buy stuff at Walmart at cheap prices imported from China, and so on and so forth. And so you get, and then the question is, where do you want to throw your lot, if any, between the two? But these are all values. About the role, proper role, size, scope of government, what sorts of freedoms a person ought to have. And some of these are based on pragmatic judgments, empirical judgments about, say, when you allow people to have firearms, it reduces crimes. That's a belief of the GOP. The Democrats tend to think that the proliferation of guns causes crime. That's an empirical disagreement. And that's something to be settled by sociologists. But the GOP also thinks you have a right to own a gun. You have a natural right to self-defense as a free person, unless you reveal yourself to be a criminal or dangerous or mentally ill or something. Whereas the Democrats say you don't have a natural right to self-defense. The Democrats tend to think you have a right to having somebody else pay your doctor bills. The GOP says pay your own damn doctor bills. And by the way, if we get the government out of health care, going to the doctor is going to be a lot more affordable.
So again, you have disagreements over what people have a right to, but also disagreements with how the world works on these empirical judgments. Final thoughts. Anybody want to have the last word on politics?
There is no last word on politics.
Yeah. It just seems like it's 6-1, half a dozen the other.
I'd say if you look at the I'll just add two more things: libertarians, and then you get your statists. So your libertarians say you should have both economic and personal freedoms. Your statist says you should have neither economic freedom nor personal freedom. So the libertarians say basically you should be able to do what you want as long as you're not hurting anybody else. And your statists say that the best way to run a society is to have some centralized authority telling everybody what to do, like North Korea. And so some people see the kind of libertarian view as kind of a synthesis between the best elements of the GOP, but your statists will say that's going the wrong way, that what you need is fewer freedoms and more state control. All right, so that's all we have time for. If you look on, I think I'll post the World's Smallest Political Quiz. You can see where we follow. There's kind of a grid there. Been around for a while, so you can follow in the political spectrum. Next time, we'll be doing student evaluations. Instructor evaluations by students, so please come for that. And also reviewing for the final.